Thank you. Thank you. Could I just see by a show of hands who has participated in any environmental impact assessment process that would be under the National Environmental Management Act? Has anyone commented or registered as an interested and affected party? It'll just help me to pitch. Okay, all right. Okay. Good. Briefly, what I'm going to cover are the following topics. I'll talk briefly about the Constitution, mechanisms to protect rights, limitations of those mechanisms, one of them being review. I'll talk about contingency fee arrangements, locus standi, which is just a fancy Latin term for legal standing. In other words, who can bring a particular matter to court. And then I'll have some concluding remarks. So I'm going to the Constitution. So basically, I could start my presentation with once upon a time in a far off land, there were some wise men who decided to draft up this Constitution. And the significant thing about our Constitution is that it has a Bill of Rights. So we have what we call the Chapter 2. Those are fundamental human rights that are contained in a Constitution. So those fundamental human rights, the most important one from an environmental point of view, is Section 24. So Section 24, that is the environmental right. Sort of the question should be, well, how did this come into the Constitution, and where does it come from, and why do we have it in the Constitution in the first place, and why is it a fundamental human right, and what does it mean? So if you look back at an international level, we know that there were developments taking place back in the late 70s and then early 80s with the development of the Brundtland Report, which then indicated what sustainable development is. It then imposed what they call sort of intergenerational equity. Those sort of things were coming through saying that we must use our environment in a manner that doesn't impact on our children's children from enjoying the same rights and from also being able to survive. So that's where this notion of sustainable development comes from. And then if we look at what our Section 24 rights says in the Constitution, our right that we describe as the environmental right, and I'll just read it quickly, I didn't want to put it up on the slide. It says that everyone has the right to an environment that is not harmful to the health or well-being, and to have the environment protected for the benefit of present and future generations through reasonable legislative and other measures that that prevent pollution and ecological degradation, promote conservation, and secure ecologically sustainable development and use of natural resources while promoting justifiable economic and social development. So basically, our Section 24 environmental right gives effect to this whole notion of sustainable development. So now we know that it's in the Constitution. We know that it's a fundamental human right, which means that it's almost absolute. There are certain limitations when you can deviate from a fundamental human right. But what does that mean from a legal point of view? In sort of my experience, when we do get clients and they come and they have a particular problem, the first thing that they almost always say is, but it's unconstitutional. Certainly there must be something in the Constitution that can help me to avoid them building a road through a wetland. But the truth is that there actually isn't. You know, so a lot of the times when we do get clients and say, well, they say it's unconstitutional, then we have to go away and examine it to determine if it's unconstitutional. Does it infringe the Section 24? Promote justifiable economic social development? That's almost difficult to prove. You're going to need economists and experts, and it's always one expert's words against the other. So that's the first thing, is the Section 24 environmental right. Now, what you also need to enforce those particular rights, you're going to need information. Because sometimes you're not quite sure, you might hear about a particular matter, but you don't quite know what it involves. So you need to get access to certain information. And we know that the Constitution has a provision that allows for access to information. That's section 32. So it allows people to, says you have the right to information. You even have the right to information that the private individual holds, but you need that information to protect your interest or a particular interest that you have, a particular right that you have. And then that right, the access to information right, was then sort of given flesh to in what we call the Promotion of Access to Information Act. That act then set out instances or circumstances or situations when you can gain access to information that is held by an organ of state, as well as information that is held by private individuals, in order for you to exercise a constitutional right, that being your Section 24 right to an environment that is not harmful to your health or well-being. So then the next issue, and this is normally where lawyers would get involved, is if you look at you have the information, you have the right to an environment. How do you go about ensuring that decisions are made in a proper manner? And we normally talk about your right to just administrative action. That's just your Section 33 right. Again, it's contained in the Constitution. It's a fundamental human right. You have the right to lawful, procedurally fair administrative action. And again, that right, the fundamental right, was then codified in legislation. It's sort of the twin sister of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. We have what we call PADJA, which is the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. And that act will then set out grounds or circumstances where, when a decision maker makes a decision on a particular matter, you can take that decision on appeal, on review, to the High Court on certain grounds. And those grounds are: was the decision procedurally fair? Was the correct processes followed? Did the decision maker have the requisite authority or power in terms of the empowering statute to actually make that particular decision? So now we know that we have a Section 24 environmental right. We enforce it by obtaining additional information through PIA. We know that we can review and have decisions set aside in terms of PADJA. And that brings me to the next one, which is locus standi, sort of enforcement. Because what we had in law traditionally is that only certain persons could actually bring actions or could bring actions to court. So if I and Cormac were involved in a motor vehicle accident, a third person couldn't claim for damages. It would either be I would have to sue Cormac, or Cormac would have to sue me. But what the Constitution does, it widened the ambit of persons that can now approach the court for an infringement of a fundamental human right. You can say it's someone acting in their own interest, someone acting in the interest of an association, someone acting in the interest of a person who can't come to court on their own behalf, and that might be future generations, although that hasn't quite been tested. So it widened the scope of persons who can bring infringements of a fundamental human right to court. So if someone infringes your Section 24 fundamental right, you can then go to court and you can say, well, I, Mr. So-and-so, am acting in the public interest. I have legal standing to bring this matter to court, and then the court will hear you. I'll talk more about that later. But perhaps if you go to the next slide, I want to talk about mechanisms to protect rights. So we've dealt with the particular rights. I just want to identify some mechanisms. Basically, in law, there are three types of ways in which you can come to court. The first one would be through an action proceedings, and that's normally for when there is a dispute of fact on a matter, or if you have been divorced, the court would then use the action proceedings. The other one is an interdict. That's either where you're trying to stop someone from doing something, or you want to get an official or organ of state to take certain steps. So it's stopping or instructing them or wanting them to take certain measures. And the other one is what I've mentioned to earlier is a review, and I've talked about Padgett before. So this is quite a unique case. This is the Max Sand matter that we talked about earlier. And this is an area in Mitchell's Plain. It's a sand dune that is was designated as public open space in terms of the land use planning ordinance, that's LUPO. And what had happened was Max Sand, a mining company, had applied for a mining right to mine that sand, or for a mining permit to mine that sand, and it had applied to the Minerals Minister. So after they submitted an environmental management plan, the Minerals Minister then granted Max Sand a mining permit to mine for sand in an area that is designated as public open space, situated in the heart of Mitchell's Plain between a primary and a high school, and as you can see, right next to a row of houses. So, and the property belonged to the city of Cape Town. So obviously when the city became aware that mining activities were taking place on an area that they had zoned public open space, the city then took Max Sand to court, not on the basis that the minister's approval of the mining permit was unlawful. That wasn't the city's argument. The city said, actually, Max Sand, you need another authorization. You need to get land use planning approval in terms of LUPO. In other words, you need to change the zoning of this land, which is public open space, to a zoning that will allow for mining. So what the city then did was they applied for an interdict to the Cape High Court, and they were granted an interdict. In other words, Max Sand was then compelled to stop the mining activities until they then obtained the requisite land use planning authorization in terms of LUPO. So there was another permit or authorization required before they could commence with mining activities. Max Sand then took the matter to the Supreme Court of Appeal and eventually to the Constitutional Court, where both courts basically held that actually, yes, Max Sand, you do need an additional approval. You need to get land use planning authorization if you want to undertake mining activities within an area that was zoned public open space, because you need to change that zoning of that particular area to allow for mining activities. And there are certain factors or circumstances or conditions that the city would take into account when it grants its approval for your change of zoning. So this is a sure. Yes, I'm going to touch on that later under review and explain exactly how much money it can actually cost. But yes, it is an astronomical amount of money. But this was just an example of where an interdict was used to actually stop environmental degradation from occurring in circumstances where these guys actually had one valid authorization. So that is, I think, probably one of the success stories. Just want to go to the next slide. Yeah, okay. This is the, basically just wanted to talk about, I don't know if people know about the Seafront for All project. It was basically an approval by the then Minister Tasneem Essop to allow for a particular development on the Sea Point Pavilion, which would be, I think it was an hotel and a few was it smaller units. I think the hotel was about 152 room hotel, but it was in an area that was previously open to the public. So what had happened in this case, and this is now different to an interdict, here we're dealing with a review. Now the interesting thing about a review application is that we're not looking at whether or not the decision is a good or bad decision. That's not the issue here. We're looking at whether all of the procedural requirements in coming to that particular decision, whether all of those boxes have been ticked. In other words, was there sufficient public consideration? Was there independence? Did you act in terms of the correct law? Did you consider relevant factors? Were irrelevant factors taken into account? So looking at, strictly speaking, procedural aspects. So what we get, again, as lawyers, what we get a lot of the time is people would say, but this is a bad decision. But that's not the test. The test is, has the decision maker complied with all the procedural requirements? And if he has, then it's impossible or very difficult to set aside a decision on review where there is compliance with all of the legal requirements. Now the issue with Seafront for all, as I mentioned, it was a review decision, and again it was down in Cape Town, and it was brought under the it was for a decision made by Tasnim Esop in terms of the Environment Conservation Act, which was the first sort of EIA regime that we had. And one of the requirements is that a consultant, even if it's a specialist consultant, needs to be independent when they prepare their specific reports. So what had happened here was that one of the consultants that were looking into the viability of such an hotel, and I think with some private units, was actually going to be appointed as the sole agent for selling those units as well. So the court, when it looked at it, said, well, actually, we think that your independence as an independent consultant, even though you're a specialist, will obviously be affected by the fact that you would be the sole person selling off these particular units. Then the court, that was one of the reasons that the court set aside the decision. The other was that the court said, well, the information that the initial decision maker had in front of them was, I think it was done in 2003. And the court said, but the decision was made about 5 years later in 2008. So there's a huge gap, and it's clear that things have changed. So the information that you, Mr. Minister, based your decision on was, oh, Mrs. Minister, Mrs. Esop, was outdated. So on that basis, the court then said the second ground is that the information is outdated, sort of irrelevant considerations were taken into account, I'm setting aside this particular decision. Now here's where it gets interesting. So what does that mean? You have spent, as someone mentioned earlier, an astronomical amount of money, and I'm assuming this would have probably have cost the Seafront for all guys about 500,000 Rand. It means that once you get the decision, the judge then says, well, now I'm referring this decision back to the MEC. So the decision gets taken back to the MEC for reconsideration, fix those material defects, and come again and make another decision. So you could get exactly the same decision, but with the material defects fixed, and you as an association has just spent 500,000 Rand in helping a developer to make sure they get the necessary approval, or at least with a robust process. So the problem with a review is that you're only looking at procedural stuff. It gets referred back to the decision maker, and a decision can be made on it again that goes against you. So it's not a particularly satisfactory remedy. It does have its merits. Sometimes you want to have a decision set aside, and you know that they won't be able to come back again to, you know, because of the lapse of time, it's going to be quite difficult for them to continue with that same particular development. So it does have its merits, but it certainly has its limitations as well. Fortunately for the seafront, for all guys, because they were successful, the court granted a cost order in their favor. So here's another thing that we have to explain as lawyers to clients. What does that mean? Because clients think, well, that means that my legal bill to the attorney will be paid in full. But it's not, because there are certain, there are different scales of cost. And normally when a lawyer engages a client, it's sort of an attorney and own client scale. In other words, we would agree on a particular fee, but when the court awards cost, is normally on a party-to-party scale. So those are determined tariffs that are normally quite lower than what your lawyer's fees are. So you probably, if you get an award of costs, you probably get hopefully about 60% of your costs back, but you will still have to pay for about 30% of the lawyer's fees, and it varies from matter to matter. So those are the limitations of review. Is that the decision gets referred back to the decision maker. You're only looking at procedural irregularities, and it's likely that you may get the same decision. Also, an important thing to remember is that you probably want to link your the remedy that I mentioned earlier, the interdict, you want to link with your review application. A good example of that would be the Chapman Speak matter, because there what had happened was, because the transport minister was so intent on constructing the toll road, even though we had clearly had issues about the legality of the construction of a toll plaza facility within a national park, the homeowners association were forced to go to court and apply for an interdict. In other words, you want to freeze the status quo, because once a development reaches a particular stage, and you go to court, even on a review application, the court will say, well, let's take the soccer stadium as an example. Well, how can I set aside this decision when the stadium is built? You know, the courts are not going to interfere. That's going to say, well, it's too late. You should have brought an interdict. Also, reviews need to be done within 6 months, 180 days from the date that the decision gets made. So you can't sit and wait at home and wonder and ponder on your, should you bring a review application or shouldn't I? You need to move quite quickly, because it does take a long time actually for you to get all these papers sorted, all of the facts sorted out. And so, sorry, just back to the Chapman Speak matter. So we had to bring an interdict application needed to stop the minister from constructing the toll plaza, and then to have another court date where we could actually talk about the merits of the matter, because one of the concerns or issues that we had was that the provincial minister had not obtained all of the authorizations necessary in order to construct a building within the national road. He needed permission from the National Minister of Environmental Affairs. And in court, the National Minister legal representative said that actually, the provincial minister doesn't have that authority. The national minister never gave them the authority to build within the national park, so they needed to obtain that authorization. But the court nevertheless still found against the homeowners association. So once the interdict remedy had fallen away and the minister could construct the toll plaza, it basically meant that the rest of the matter actually fell away, because once the building is there, it's highly unlikely that the court will say, please remove the building. So an interdict and review application are normally linked together, which again increases the cost. But the interdict is important because it results in a holding position until such time as your review application can be heard, and if you don't apply for an interdict, you might have a situation where the building is done and the court is unlikely to interfere. Let's go to the next slide. Ooh, yes, this is another thing that we get quite frequently is clients would come and say, but what about contingency fee arrangements? These are basically situations where you would act on behalf of a client for free, and then when you are successful, like normally in a claim for damages, so when you are successful, you would then recover a portion of your fees from the claim amount that you've got from the other side. So basically, in effect, your client only pays if you are successful. If you're not successful, then you don't get any money. Sorry, I've got a picture of this Gulf of Mexico pollution with BP. Because the point I want to make that normally when an environmental incident happens, it's damage that occurs to the environment. It's seldom that it's damage that relates directly to us. As it's not damages that you suffer, it's damage that the environment suffers or experience. So a contingency fee arrangement is difficult to work in such circumstances because you don't have the environment as your client. The environment doesn't come to you and knock on the door and say, I've just been damaged or injured, please could you go to court and get damages for me, you know? So contingency fee arrangements doesn't work in a lot of environmental law matters. And then again, if you look at the types of remedies, normally what we try to do as environmental lawyers, we're either trying to interdict someone from doing something like in the Maxand matter, or we are interdicting and taking the matter on review. In other words, we're challenging a minister or delegated official's decision, and we hope to have that particular decision set aside, and hopefully the matter can be reconsidered. Next slide. Yeah. Locus standa, I had to put in a picture of a beautiful girl. But basically what this comes to is, again, it's legal standing. Who can go to court? Who can bring particular matters? We know that the National Environmental Management Act, NEMA, has the same similar provisions to the Constitution that allows for greater or wider legal standing. So if you want to act in the public interest, like the Residents Association of Hart Bay, you can go and bring a matter to court and say, this litigation that I'm bringing to stop this construction of the Stoll Plaza, I'm bringing in the public interest. Now, you'll note that I've talked about the remedies earlier about the interdict in the Maxand matter, where the city of Cape Town, the owner of that property, then applied for an interdict. There is an anomaly in the law at the moment where they've created wide locus standi in terms of the Constitution and in terms of NEMA in relation to environmental law matters. But when you bring you bring an interdict, you need to prove certain things. The first one is you have to have what they call a prima facie right. So you must be able to show a strong right. And normally sometimes it's linked to your review application. You will show that there are clear grounds of procedural irregularities. Then you have to show that you have no alternative remedy. In other words, that the interdict is basically the best remedy available to stop this particular thing from happening. And then you have to show damages. And I'm talking about a final interdict, a slightly different for an interim interdict, sort of the two different types of interdicts. Now, the Maxand manor, but the sand dunes, that was for a final interdict. In other words, all that the city or we had to show were that we have a prima facie right, and we've said that these guys need to obtain land use planning authorization. That was the one. We showed that we had no alternative remedy. we said that even though there are provisions in LUPO that allows for criminal sanctions, that is really not going to help us. If the dune is gone, it's gone. And we showed that there are damages. So that if you allow these guys to continue mining until this legal point has been resolved, the dune will be gone. And if you find in our favor, Mr. Judge, how are you going to get the dune back? So you need to give us this final interdict so we can deal with this particular legal point. Now here's where it becomes tricky, because I talked about locus standi, you're acting in the public interest. Let's take the Chapman Speak matter. Here we applied for a what we call an interim interdict. In other words, give us the interdict now to stop the construction of the toll plaza so we can argue about the merits of whether or not the provincial minister needs to get approval from the national minister for construction of a building within the national park. So it was a holding position until the merits of the matter could be decided later. So for an interim interdict, the requirements are slightly different. There's one additional requirement: you have to show balance of convenience. So in other words, if the court grants you the order that you are asking for, who's it going to, what are the adverse consequences that will attach to the other side, and what are the adverse consequences that will attach to you? So what the provincial minister then argued was that if you grant this interim interdict, the consequences for province and to the taxpayers of this province is going to be astronomical. There are penalty provisions that will have to be paid. There's a whole list and probably an over-inflated amount of a couple of hundred million that would have to be paid. So the balance of convenience, so they argued, favored the provincial or authorities or the provincial minister. But the other issue is damages. How could we as the association show damages? Because remember, we're not suffering anything. We're not the owner of that particular land. The property that's affected belongs in effect to Sanparks, and they were not they were party to the matter, but they certainly weren't on our side. They were on the sort of respondents. So how could we show damages? The only damages were the damages to the in environment. And because of facts, some of the damages had happened consequent to the second application. So the whole issue of damages had become, had basically come and gone. We couldn't show or show strong enough that there was damages. So the point I want to make is that when it comes to an interdict and locus standi, is that it's difficult to get an interdict, an interim interdict for environmental law matters, because even though we have this wider provisions for locus standi, in other words, who can act, you can act in the public interest, we have those provisions in the Constitution and NEMA that creates wider legal standing, when you come to apply for an interdict, the court wants to know what are the damages that you have suffered. And then if you are acting in the environment, in the interest of the environment, it becomes difficult to show that those particular damages. Now, why I say this, well, that is an anomalous situation for me in the law in relation to the interdicts. But the interesting thing is that when it comes to an infringement in terms of LUPO, which is the Land Use Planning Ordinance, the position is entirely different, because if your neighbor is building a development that doesn't conform to those land use planning schemes, you can go off to court and apply for an interdict And all you need to show is that the development is unlawful. You know, that it doesn't meet the requirements of the scheme. That you have no alternative remedy. And the court is more than likely to grant you that interdict on that basis alone. In actual fact, its discretion to grant you the interdict is quite limited. But when it comes to environmental law matters, land use planning is an environmental law matter as well, but sort of the wider environmental law matters, you see that the law hasn't quite developed to that extent where all you need to show is that actually you're infringing a law in terms of the National Environmental Management Act, one of them, therefore, Mr. Judge, give me the particular interdict to stop this particular unlawful development. The law hasn't developed to that extent yet in relation to environmental law matters, and it is a huge, I think it's a huge stumbling block and a huge weakness, because what's the point of having this wide provisions with regard to legal standing, but you might not be able to get an interdict, you might not be able to get a holding position, and by the time you get to a high court review, things would be all lost and gone. But I guess, yeah, that's from a legal from a legal point of view. I mean, what we want to do is promote sustainable development, and if you look at sort of another point, if you look at the National Environmental Management Act, NEMA, and its listed activities, it doesn't look like even those listed activities, for me, they don't really give effect to sustainable development. It's all about the tick box exercise. It's not taking us down the path that we should be going. And it seems like no one is asking the question, is what we're doing leading to sustainable development? And the answer seems to be no. And that's my sort of last slide. And I think I feel sorry for Mr. Polar Bear, because I think it's going to do a lot more swimming in time to come, because it's clear that we're going down a particular path that is unsustainable, and it's going to have consequences for Mr. Polar Bear and our future generations, our children's children. And sadly, I don't think that our current environmental regime is helping much. It's helping, but it's too little, too late. Cool, and that's the end of my talk. That's on 45 minutes. Are there any questions? Okay.